for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Fighting continues in Ukraine despite a ceasefire agreement. European finance ministers meet to try to solve the crisis over Greece's bailout. And President Obama calls for a united global front to combat terrorism. Here for the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Indira Lakshman on with Bloomberg, and Mark Landler of The New York Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Hello.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning,
Diane.
Good
to see you. Indira Lakshman on the White House convened a three-day summit on counterterrorism this week. What is the president saying about his approach to the growing threat of terrorism?
Right. Well, President Obama chose his words very carefully, and I thought it was really interesting to listen to his speech yesterday, which was in pretty marked contrast from the tone that John Kerry took speaking right before him, which was quite emotional and passionate. And President Obama gave us what we've come to expect from him, which is a kind of very carefully worded speech in which he talked about some of the causes behind extremism. And he was very careful to try to separate extremism itself from the religion Islam, saying that this is about extremists and this is their perverted interpretation and we need to push back against this perverse view of Islam. And then he also talked about how governments need to avoid sectarianism. He was, of course, referring to Iraq specifically in this case, and also need to try to address the economic and political grievances that some of the people who become radicalized have, which is completely separate from religion.
David.
I thought that President Obama was trying to reposition the fight against ISIS. In the George Bush years of a decade ago, we thought of the GWAT, as it was called, the Global War on Terror. And we now don't use that phrase, at least the president doesn't. It's the effort to counter violent extremism. We've gone from GWAT to CVE. And the different words actually have important differences. The idea is to avoid alienating the Muslim world, making Muslims feel they are the target of this attack, and to draw Muslim leaders into a real coalition in which they increasingly, it's hoped, will be the loudest voices and will lead the messaging, saying to their Muslim citizens, this path is wrong, it's deadly, it's going to kill Muslims. So this conference this week was an attempt to come up with a different face down the road, a more Muslim and tolerant face. And we'll see. Obama's been attacked, as always, for the way in which he's done this. It's been seen as too soft. But I'll perhaps let others talk about that. But it was in significant part about branding.
And Mark Landler, what did you make of Rudy Giuliani's comments?
Well, Rudy Giuliani is an illustration of exactly what David was talking about, that this issue is so quickly inflamed and that the very dispassionate, almost scholastic tone that President Obama took in talking about the threat is going to be viewed as weak and inadequate by his critics.
But he went farther. He said it's clear President Obama does not love this country.
Yeah, and he doubled down on it when he was criticized and said, lest anyone think that there was an implication of a racist content to the remarks, he pointed out that his mother was white, so how could he be accused of that? I sort of think the Rudy Giuliani thing is a headline but a sideshow to a very interesting week substantively on how you combat extremism. And one of the things that David alluded to a moment ago is that there's this even disagreement about the semantics of it. Do you refer to it as radical Islamic extremism, Muslim extremism? The White House has pointedly decided not to and come under a great deal of fire for avoiding that. There's a sort of a separate issue that this conference was grappling with, which is the asymmetry in setting the narrative. ISIS in particular has proven to be extremely adroit and aggressive in getting across a narrative, a narrative that is at least somewhat glamorous and attractive to disaffected young people. The State Department has tried over the years in small and fairly half-hearted ways to counter that narrative. And this phrase, countering the narrative, is sort of now all the rage in Washington. But the reality of it is, against the huge onslaught of 90,000 tweets a day and a very avid use of social media by extremist groups, what the United States and its allies are sort of countering with is paltry. And while there's an effort underway to expand the parts of the State Department and other American agencies that engage in counter-narrative, there's a general recognition that at the moment there's a real imbalance, and that the U.S. and its allies simply need to do more, perhaps harnessing the private sector to make use of social media and try to push back on this onslaught of messaging.
And then, yes, yesterday, we learned that the U.S. may be planning an attack on the city of Mosul. Why announce this now when they're talking about a spring assault?
I read the accounts of the Los Angeles Times story that predicted this coming within a few months. I've just come back from Iraq and was in Nineveh province, where Mosul is located, traveling with the Kurdish Peshmerga fighters who surrounded it. They don't want to take that city, and they say, frankly, that no one else is prepared to. And I would be surprised if this attack was months off. I just had lunch today met today with an Iraqi official who said, be careful about those reports. So I'd urge listeners not to take a few months as a given. I think this is still being examined. And the main issue is, whenever it happens, who's going to do it? Who's really ready to take this fight? And I think by most estimates, the Iraqi security forces themselves are not ready. The Kurds don't want to do it. President Obama has said the U.S. will not do it. So I'm skeptical it's months away.
And you, Indira?
Well, I mean, I've heard the same reports about, you know, with numbers up as high as 20,000 Iraqi troops supposedly being involved. But I do think that number would far outstrip the number of ISIS soldiers who there are inside Mosul, as far as we know. And yet they're also very hard dug in already, and they're mixed amongst the community. We know that. That makes any target in Mosul very difficult because you'd be hitting civilians. I mean, I think it brings up the larger question, which is how much of an air war, how can you win against ISIS if it's just being done through an air war? And as David points out, President Obama has made very clear that he does not want U.S. ground forces involved. He's gotten some pushback from Republicans in Congress who are particularly keen, like John McCain. But you do have to ask the question, even if you don't want to see any American ground forces involved, how can you win this war from above? And I'm not sure it can be done.
And what about Egypt's airstrikes launched against ISIS targets in Libya, for example? What's happened there? How effective have they been? And what has the U.S. reaction been?
Well, the Egyptians took these airstrikes in retaliation for the beheading of a number of Coptic Christians, Egyptians who had actually gone over to Libya in search, young men in search of work. And it's, you know, destabilized an already chaotic situation in Libya, which is sort of not a functioning state anymore. It's effectively a number of factions that have divided the country, two main factions. I think the threat here and the worry on the U.S. side is that the Egyptians are inflaming a situation without having thought through where it goes. And, you know, the Egyptians have issued a call for perhaps a peacekeeping force or some international effort to stabilize Libya. The United States is not going to be receptive to that. President Obama drew some very clear lessons from the U.S. intervention in Libya a few years ago, and I think he'd be extremely disinclined. But, you know, clearly it's another area in the Middle East where you now have the potential for even greater chaos. We see it in Syria, Iraq, Yemen. And so it's one more headache for an administration that's already grappling with several in the region.
And there are now reports that the executioner we've seen in the latest video could be an American. David, what do we know?
We just, watching the video, we know that he spoke in American accented English, and we know that more than 100 Americans have traveled into the Syria-Iraq battle space of the Islamic State and may have traveled to other places where these new Islamic State cells are establishing themselves, such as Libya. I just would note one point over the last couple of weeks. Americans often say, looking at the horror of Islamic State and other extremist groups in the Middle East, where are the Muslim voices of protest? And we finally have been seeing and hearing some. The Jordanians are fighting back hard after the burning alive of their pilot. The Egyptians, these roughly 20 Copts, are killed. And Egypt bombs Libya, saying these Coptic Christians are Egyptians. So you're beginning to see some pushback. And that, for all the chaos in the region, I think that's welcome.
Short break. Right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org.
Welcome back. David Ignatius of the Washington Post is here, as is Indira Lakshman on Bloomberg News, Mark Landler of the New York Times. We were talking about ISIS, the kind of damage it has wrought, and the New York Times has a front page story, Mark, this morning on the shock value of these ISIS videos. Why are they so effective?
Well, one of the points that article makes is that that ISIS actually uses some fairly expert techniques, entertainment techniques, and that these videos, in addition to being grisly beyond description, also have very sort of slick production values. The example that the article cites is this recent video of the Coptic Christians being beheaded in Libya, where they're sort of marched down to a beach at sunset, and there are close-ups of the of their captors laying hands on the kidnapped young people, and then the picture of the beheadings, which then turn the waves red with blood. And so it isn't just the horrible nature of the imagery. It's the slick and carefully packaged nature of the imagery that gives it an allure, particularly to a vulnerable or a disaffected audience, that makes it very, very dangerous and a sort of a new level. I think the West has reacted largely to the horrific images, but it isn't just that they're horrific. They're at some level attractive, and that's where the real sinister danger of it lies.
All right, let's talk about what's happening in Ukraine, and the fighting is continuing, David. Despite a ceasefire agreement, leaders are trying to salvage the deal. What's the latest?
The latest is that the Ukrainian army managed just barely to escape from the scene of the most intense post-ceasefire fighting, a rail junction called Dolbatsev, if I'm pronouncing
Debaltseva.
It. Debaltseva. Yeah. Which is in this eastern Ukrainian sector. It's important that they escape because had these nearly 3,000 people not gotten out, they would have been held, it's argued, as a bargaining chip by the rebels for a whole new round of bitter negotiations. The Russian behavior and that of their East Ukrainian breakaway allies has been absolutely cynical in this latest episode, as has been the case since the initial invasion of Crimea a year ago. The Russian-backed forces with Putin in attendance reached another Minsk agreement for a ceasefire that was supposed to stabilize the situation, facing the threat the U.S. would provide weapons to the Ukrainian government and that Germany would lead Europe in punishing additional sanctions. The Russians appeared to accept a pathway for de-escalation and then promptly went the other direction. And I do think at some point, with such obvious Russian defiance of not simply of requests made by the West, but of their seeming agreement to those requests to get a deal with a time in which things will take place, there is going to be a feeling in Washington and other capitals, something additional has to be done. We can't keep repeating this cycle, they'll now push for the next key strategic point. They'll want to take Mariupol or some other connecting point with Crimea, and then what do we do then?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is critical. Last week, we saw the European Union add some additional sanctions to Russia, even after the Minsk agreement, the second Minsk agreement, had been signed. And Russia complained immediately and said, how can you do this when we've just signed the agreement? Of course, the sanctions have been, in a way, retroactive, let's say. They've been sort of like referring to things that Russia has already done in the past. And on the case of this particular city, which they stayed in, Debaltseva, I think it's really interesting that the rebel forces backed by Russia, supposedly with Russian equipment, according to the United States, which the United States believes Russian soldiers are operating for them, the reason they stayed is because it is this critical rail hub that connects Donetsk and Luhansk and gives them this sort of land bridge that they need, which makes it seem as if the calls for autonomy are not really genuine or sincere, that what they really want is some sort of independent country or some, again, the ability to annex themselves to Russia.
So David's use of the word cynical is right on
absolutely,
target.
Absolutely. And that add to that Mariupol, they could end up having a bridge to Transnistria, which is seemingly what the Russians have wanted from the beginning. And at the same time, Russia is testing NATO at every opportunity. We had Russian jets flying along the UK coast and having to be escorted out by UK forces, something they've been doing outside of Scandinavia as well. So, Putin is definitely pushing the limits, and I think the only way he can truly be held back is through more economic pressure.
Mark.
And this will, bring to a point the debate that's been simmering in Washington for some time about whether the U.S. needs to move beyond sanctions to providing lethal defensive weapons to the Ukrainians. It's interesting. This debate feels like it's unfolded a little bit like the debate we had a couple of years ago about aiding the moderate rebels in Syria, where you had a growing consensus around the idea that it was necessary to do this, and one person was holding out, and that person is the president of the United States, the one person whose vote really matters. It's clear that President Obama doesn't really want to do this. His European allies really don't want him to do it. Angela Merkel spoke out very forcefully against it. But there does seem to be a growing consensus that that's probably a step the U.S. will have to take. And I think it will actually then elevate this confrontation to another level. Separately, the president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko's calling for a UN peacekeeping force. That's a difficult prospect for a number of reasons. One, the Russians would almost certainly veto that if it came up in the UN Security Council. Secondly, the Europeans don't want it. The Europeans are still clinging to the idea that somehow this second Minsk agreement can be implemented. And so there's a lot, there'd be a lot of headwinds to that proposal. But I think that the U.S. Idea of lethal weapons is something that will probably be hearing more about in the coming weeks.
Do you believe the president will move in that direction?
Well, administration officials think it's likely to happen, and it did eventually happen in the Syrian precedent. But I would just note, as a matter of this president's temperament and behavior, that he can become very dug in on these issues. So I wouldn't rule out the fact that he continues to resist, even if several members of his cabinet line up in favor of it.
But, you know, he's probably still got the American people on his side.
I think that's right. I think the polling shows that the U.S. public does not want to get involved militarily in Ukraine, in Syria, in Iraq. And on top of that, we don't really have any proof that if the United States were to give lethal assistance to the Ukrainian government and forces, that it would necessarily help. It could make the situation worse, which is what the president has argued all along. And I wanted to say one thing about the poor Ukrainian soldiers who were trying to retreat, actually having given up in Debaltseve. Although the president, Poroshenko, said that 80% of them got out alive, there was a fascinating piece in the New York Times where they were on the ground interviewing the soldiers there who said that at most one-third of them made it out alive. So, you know, there was a really harrowing story about how they were trying to get out secretly and were being fired upon even as they retreated.
The story in the New York Times that Indira is referring to has a haunting Tolstoy-like quality about retreat under fire, disastrous losses. It's a very powerful piece. I think, like Mark, that the pressure on President Obama to move to provide additional weapons to Ukraine is going to be overwhelming.
It's clear that how would Putin react to that?
Well, you have to be prepared for Putin to call our bluff to go to the next stage. But I think the point about this idea of providing more arms is Putin seems willing to do that anyway. He doesn't stop even when there's an internationally negotiated ceasefire agreement. He keeps going for his strategic targets. And so what these weapons would do would mean that if he decides to go forward, he's going to face a very bloody campaign across Ukraine, because although the southeast around Donetsk and Luhansk is pro-Russian, most of Ukraine isn't, and indeed is moving fast the other direction.
All right.
The Russians would be looking at a very, very difficult, dangerous campaign.
Let's talk about the Greek debt. Talks broke down early this week. Where are we now?
Well, this story, it's unclear how it's going to really finish. I mean, basically, the precedent for these sorts of negotiations is that the Germans hold out. And then when there really does seem to be, they do seem to be on a precipice where you have the prospect of Greece leaving the Union, usually then they come to terms and they tell the German people, look, we had to do this to maintain the currency
and
union.
And what is it that they would have to do?
The Greeks are seeking a sort of what amounts to a bridge loan. They're looking for a six-month extension on a debt repayment plan. This has been a drama now for several years. The more combustible elements this time Myanmar. You have a new left-wing government in Greece that was elected saying we're not going to submit to the kind of draconian conditions that have been imposed on previous Greek governments. And so we're, in effect, going to renegotiate from a very different position. And so that's the process that's been underway. You've had this new Greek government negotiating with the European Central Bank, the Germans, and the IMF. And the question is largely turns on what are the conditions that will be imposed on Greece. The Greek government has made some of its own proposals. The Germans have been resistant, but there were in the last, I've been reading in the last few hours, a few signals from the Germans that they see some glimmerings of a possible deal. And history would tell us that that's probably how it will play out.
I think Mark is reading that right. The Germans today, which is supposed to be the crunch day, Merkel made clear that she does not want to see Greece leave the euro. And in a sense, that's Greece's biggest chip, is that it could upset the entire European monetary system. As with Ukraine, European monetary policy is a game of chicken right now. It's in every direction you look, you see people taking ever more extreme steps, and others tempted to call their bluffs. Even if there's an agreement that's patched together, the fundamental question of how Europe is going to get to a more stable system for adapting the differences between European economies is anything but clear. You know, the only argument for a Greek exit from the euro is that you'd have a mechanism, the exchange rate, that would allow Greece or any other country that left to adjust. Absent that, there is no sign that Europe is prepared to deal with that problem, least of all the Germans.
But at the same time, is there simply a lack of trust on the part of Germany and other countries that Greece will just keep postponing the inevitable?
Look, I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that there's going to be a final deal worked out before Greece falls off the edge, which would be in about 10 days' time. So I think everybody knows that it's going to take months to work out some sort of a deal. And Syriza, the new Greek, you know, government, has not said really, I mean, I think that although they've said we don't want to pay the price, we don't want our people to pay the price that you would require us, neither do I think that they're completely unreasonable. I think that they would be willing to figure out some sort of a deal. And the difference, which Mark sort of referred to, is the difference between a bridge loan versus a continuation. And the Germans want a continuation. And we're talking about $273 billion worth of debt, which is more than the Greek can afford right now, so they're going to have to come up with something to solve it.
Indira Lakshman on Bloomberg News, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David, the Syrian city of Aleppo is still under siege, but there's some talk of a ceasefire.
For the last 3 or 4 months, the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, has talked about a program of local ceasefires, especially for Aleppo. He speaks of a freeze as opposed to a ceasefire, thinking that that would require less loss of face for the fighters. And there was an announcement this week that such a freeze in the Aleppo area is taking place. It's way too early to know whether that is credible. But that's a way forward that the UN, and as discussed at length with the White House, as people look at the situation in Syria, there simply are not good alternatives. The moderate rebels that we once hoped would be a viable opposition force to the Assad regime's army and to Hezbollah, which is supporting it, have all but collapsed. So you have super extremists from the al-Qaeda-backed Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Nusra Front, and from ISIS fighting against the regime. And people looking at this have concluded maybe the best alternative is to stabilize the situation with a freeze, get the north of Syria, which has been the most fertile breeding ground for extremism, under some kind of control, begin to get contact between what moderates there are on the ground in Aleppo and the regime, and rebuild some trust for a later campaign going east toward Raqqa, which is the headquarters of the Islamic Front.
What about the weaponry and radios the U.S. is said to give to moderate Syrian rebels?
Well, again, against that rather grim backdrop that David just sketched out, the U.S. is beginning now to supply pickup trucks with machine guns and GPS equipment that would allow rebels, it's not entirely clear who these rebels are, to call in airstrikes. And this comes also amid signs that the long-awaited training and equipping effort that the United States is going to pursue with the moderate rebels is actually going to begin to happen initially in Jordan and then later in Turkey. But again, the question here is, who are we training and equipping at a time when the moderate rebels have almost ceased to exist as a force on the ground in Syria? And even if we identify some numbers of people and train and equip them, how then are we going to deal with the question of who they fight? The U.S.'s agenda is to fight ISIS. Their agenda might be equally to fight Assad, and that's why the status of Aleppo and whether there's a freeze or a ceasefire becomes important, because if there's a perception among rebels that Assad is on the march, is about to seize parts of Aleppo that he's been out of for a long time, that could really test the loyalties and allegiances of these rebels, and they could turn their fire on Assad, which we at the moment don't want to see happen.
Mark Lantler of the New York Times. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, time to open the phones. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education, dedicated to empowering education changemakers across America every day to improve the learning process. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Leslie Gore, who recorded this hit when she was a teenager, died this week. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with her and to an interview with former poet laureate Philip Levine, who died Saturday. Several of his poems drew on what he experienced working in a factory.
There was fire, there was noise, it was like bedlam.
Join us.
Welcome back. It's time to open the phones. Let's go to Joe in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. You're on the air.
Diane, first I'd like to thank you and your production staff and your brilliant guests who day after day give us the great gift of your wonderful program.
Thank you so much.
Graham Wood has been on public radio and has written a very long but very tightly and well done article in The Atlantic.
Yes, he was actually on this program earlier this week.
I thought that I heard him there.
Yeah.
I was wondering what David, Indira, and Mark thought about his viewpoint, especially in contrast to President Obama's talk yesterday.
And specifically, what do you mean, Joe?
Well, I found it very hypocritical that the ISIS warriors seem to subscribe to the medieval point of view of Islam, and yet use tweet and use YouTube and use AK-47s, which are very, very modern. So it seems to me that they're sort of talking out of both sides of their mouth, and no one has called them on that. But the medieval point of view of their interpretation of ISIS, of Islam seems to have been overlooked, I thought, in the president's remarks yesterday.
All right, David.
If Joe or any other listeners have the stomach for it, you can see exactly the way in which ISIS is trying to fuse this mix of the most traditional ideas of Islam from the time of the Prophet Muhammad with the most modern tools of communication. In their magazine. Their magazine is called Dabiq, and if you search for it online, this comes with a warning, make sure you want to do this, you'll see the appeals that they make. And it is the most traditional, medieval, grim stuff, not simply the killing of hostages, but they celebrate throwing somebody accused of sexual crimes from a tower in Raqqa, which is their capital. They talk about stoning a woman who had committed improper sexual activities. And there are pictures and kind of celebrating this is the way we're going to live. You hear reports from the areas that where ISIS has taken control that at least some of the citizens who were used to more modern living are absolutely appalled. I was told when I was in Iraq that people in Mosul are required to designate individuals, who will in effect, be hostages for them if they go outside to do something because it's so repressive and people are afraid that the people will leave Mosul and give information. So it's a very, These are absolutely committed people, as you'll see if you look at their magazine. It is said by the fighters I talked to in Iraq that when they run out of ammunition, rather than surrender, they will all gather themselves in a vehicle and blow themselves up.
And, by the way, if you'd like to read Graham Wood's article, it's in the March issue of The Atlantic. You can go to our website, drshow.org, and connect to it from there. Go ahead, Indira.
I just want to say that I think Joe herself has given a terrific analysis just in the way she asked the question.
Exactly.
And I would say that I think the reason President Obama doesn't want to acknowledge that in his speech yesterday is because that's not the way that most Muslims in the year 2015 see their religion. And that is why he is saying we need to push back against this perverse, warped view of Islam. Well, by most modern Muslims' view, it is warped. I mean, it's medieval. It's completely anachronistic. Just in the same way that we're not practicing Christianity the way it was practiced in the year 500 or Judaism or any other religion. It's not the same. And so I think that's what he's talking about when he's pushing back. He's saying, let's not accept this as the real, teaching of Islam, because that's not what it is. 2,000 years have gone by and the world is different.
Well, and the criticism of President Obama on this is that he's just not facing reality and he's not being honest, and that the way to combat this is to sort of reckon with it instead of pretending that it's not there and that it's not part of some ancient Islamic tradition. I mean, that the critics say, well, until you acknowledge it's there, you can't really combat it. President Obama says no. I mean, the other key thing that President Obama doesn't want to do is offend our Muslim allies. He's got more than a dozen of them in the anti-ISIS coalition. And if he begins talking about radical Islamic terrorism on a daily basis, that actually causes fissures in the coalition. So he worries about that as well, in addition to the Islamic people generally.
Agreeing with Mark, but just adding one point, I think one thing that U.S. counterterrorism specialists and the White House have decided is that the United States simply is not a credible messenger in telling Muslims what Islam is or isn't. That message has to be passed by people who are respected as authorities. And indeed, more of that is ahead. I'm told that there will be over the next several days a conference for Muslims only in Mecca, hosted by Saudi Arabia, to talk about counterterrorism, counter-messaging. I'm told that there will be a gathering within the next month to 6 weeks at Al-Azhar University in Cairo, the traditional seat of mainstream Sunni learning and jurisprudence, in which Al-Azhar will speak about what Islam is, try to speak out to young people, try to provide imams to help not simply in Arab countries, but in France, in Britain. I mean, you talk to French people about how they're going to deal with their fast-growing Muslim population. They just don't know. They don't give you good answers. So here's an effort by the Muslim world to say, this is our religion. We care about where it's going, and we're going to take the lead as messengers.
All right, to Jim in Wellington, Colorado. You're on the air.
Hi, Diana and panel. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have a comment regarding Ukraine. 2 weeks ago, I read an article, and I believe USA Today, where the U.S. Air Force is sending a squadron of 12 A-10 aircraft to Spangdahlem, Germany. And the article mentioned that they would be further deployed to forward operating bases in the area. The A-10 was designed to destroy artillery, specifically tanks, and it's a very, very lethal weapon in that regard. Very effective and has been demonstrated in Afghanistan and Iraq over the last 30 years or so. I would like to know the panel's opinion on what kind of a signal that does send to Putin and to our NATO allies, and if this is a sign of further U.S. involvement in that area.
David.
Well, the A-10 is a fearsome weapon. When it was used in Afghanistan, it triggered the pell-mell flight of the Taliban in the entry in 2001 into Kabul. The sending A-10s to Ukraine would be a very powerful signal that the U.S. Is going to back the government there with much stronger weapons. I had not heard that A-10s were being considered, but that may be behind the curve.
I think at this point it's also just a message to Russia about NATO's strength and NATO's solidarity. I mean, just in the same way that we've seen rotations of troops, of NATO forces in the Baltic states and in Poland, it's a way to send a message that, look, we're protecting our flank. I don't think at this point they're sending them to Ukraine yet. I think the idea is they're reinforcing in Germany our forces there, but it's certainly, I think, meant to be a signal to Russia to not do more. There's been plenty of signaling to Russia. They just haven't paid attention to the signal, although certainly we hear from administration officials, well, it would be so much worse if we hadn't created disincentives for them.
All right. To Sycamore, Illinois. Hamish, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I basically have a comment that ISIS is operating the same way that the Nazis did in World War II when they first started out. The Middle East countries need to band together and hit them as a united front. They need to get rid of their prejudices and among the tribes. And then when they do that, then the rest of the world will follow and help them, and there's no way that ISIS can survive then.
Well, I think the listener makes a perfectly valid point, and that's the point that President Obama has been making and made several times at this conference in the past week, that he's seeking solidarity and a real front of Muslim countries coming together. And he to be sure, has assembled quite an impressive group of of Arab and Muslim countries for the air campaign against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. What, you know, as I think is implicit in the comment that we just heard, is the idea that the Islamic world is complicated, and that in its early days, the group that became ISIS was probably getting financial support, continues to get financial support from some elements of the Islamic world, and that's why it's very difficult to really conceive of this as a black and white issue where everybody is on one side and ISIS is on the other. It rarely is that way in the Muslim world, and it isn't in this case, and that's been why the Syrian civil conflict and civil war has been so extraordinarily difficult for the United States and others to figure out how to respond to.
In there are civilian casualties in Afghanistan, the highest since 2009. What's happening?
Yeah, it's really, really disturbing. We saw that the civilian casualties, as counted by the United Nations, were 22% up last year. And this is a time when the war is supposed to be over. You know, the United States and ISAF have essentially withdrawn their combat forces, is the idea, and were meant to be just down to, you know, the bare bones. And so we saw the civilian casualties surpassing 10,000 for the first time since they started their record keeping, since the United Nations started their record keeping. And for Afghan security forces, last year was the deadliest year since the war began in 2001.
So
it shows that, I mean, I think it's really hurting the Afghans to not have NATO and U.S.-led forces there.
Well, one of the issues is the nature of the conflict. With the departure of ISAF in the United States, the Afghan security forces don't have the kind of air support that the Americans, ISAF, and the Afghans had when the U.S. was involved. And that, in effect, what that air support did is it made it very difficult for the Taliban to mass in any large numbers. Lacking that element, they are able to mass. And so the nature of the conflict is now much more of a ground conflict, really a hand-to-hand battle between the Afghan forces and the Taliban, and that makes it more bloody. Add to that the fact that there's an increased use of roadside explosives, of suicide bombings, and some of the other things that we have seen in Iraq during a similar transitional period, and then you have a higher number of civilian casualties. So you have a greater number of casualties being taken by the Afghan security forces, and then greater collateral damage to the civilian population. And I guess in a way, the thing that's sort of grim about this is this is what we wanted. We wanted the Afghans to be responsible for their own security, and that's what we're seeing play out now.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David.
The situation in Afghanistan, as these numbers show, is horrifying, as it's been for years. The only point that I would note, and I'm basing this on a conversation 2 weeks ago with Ashraf Ghani, the new president, is that despite widespread predictions that as the United States and NATO withdrew in Afghanistan, there would be a return to the civil war full scale, that hasn't happened yet. It was thought that the government in Kabul would collapse, that the Tajiks would retreat to their militias, and it would be back to general quarters, and you'd kind of re-loop to the way it was when the Taliban were running things. So far, we're not seeing that scenario. Indeed, there were interesting news reports this week that Ghani's preferred strategy, which is to get Pakistan to encourage the Taliban to come in for negotiations with the government, may be having a little bit of success. And I think the reason why would be, you know, Afghans are like most people. They don't want to have perpetual war. And for the Taliban, seeing that the central government in Kabul isn't going to disappear, it may be better to negotiate now, the argument would go, than to let this anarchy that's killing their people as well as their adversaries continue.
All right. Dan, one last call from Santiago in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the death of Mr. Nisman in Argentina. According to WikiLeaks, in 2010, there's 196 cables that confirm the collaboration between Mr. Nisman and the U.S. Embassy to the extent that his draft was corrected by people at the U.S. Embassy. And I wanted to ask if any of your panelists had any comments about not only the connection between Mr. Nisman and the American embassy in Buenos Aires, but also between Mr. Nisman and the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires.
Any comments?
Everything surrounding Nisman, his work and his death is now, for me, shrouded in mystery. This is, you know, it's a bizarre chain of events. It's deeply troubling to people in Argentina, and you can only hope that there's going to be some kind of legitimate investigation, because I think people, you know, the questions you're asking, I can't begin to answer those, but obviously they're circulating widely in Latin America and here.
And by the way, we were speaking of Afghanistan. I just want to let listeners know that the First Lady of Afghanistan is going to be on this program on Monday. I'm sure many of you will want to listen in and talk with her. She was born in Lebanon, but has spent a great deal of time here in the States, in Washington, D.C., and I'm looking forward to speaking with her. David Ignatius, he's a columnist for The Washington Post. His latest novel is The Director, which is currently being made into a movie.
We hope.
We hope. Indira Lakshmanan, diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News. Mark Landler, he's White House correspondent with The New York Times. Thank you all.
Thanks, Diane.
Thanks, Diane.
Stay warm, everybody, and have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.